So I'm here with Scott today, and we're talking about Israel, sort of foreign policy, domestic politics, and sort of everything that sort of, makes up this, country. So let's start with something that's of controversy, because it's Israel during the Arab Spring. And, from my perspective as a scholar of the Middle East, I've, read a lot about what Turkey's doing during the Arab Spring, what Iran is doing, and what the United States and Europe, and, there's a lot of papers about this stuff. And, the big question is, what is Israel doing for the Arab Spring? Walk us through a general approach that Israel has done, or is trying to do, and sort of how it's calibrating, in a general sense, calibrating itself, towards this huge, tumult, this huge political change.
Sure. So Israel generally sees itself as surrounded by neighbors who threaten it. And so a lot of its foreign policy is to try and keep the Arab Spring outside of Israel to try and mitigate the damage. So most of Israel's strategy over the past 2 or 3 years has been to try and batten down the hatches and prevent any of the effects of the Arab Spring from permeating the border. So that's one of the reasons we've seen some reluctance for Israel to get involved in a lot of the conflicts, and another reason that they've been reluctant to comment on, when we've seen protests in Egypt or now the ongoing violence in Syria. Israel's afraid to get involved because it's afraid of being seen as sort of a lightning rod. And already President Assad has tried to somehow link the Syrian opposition to being part of a Zionist plot. And Israel understands that that's a risk that it takes anytime it gets involved in some of these volatile situations. The reason that this is particularly threatening is because there are so many moving parts that it becomes really hard for Israel to design a security strategy, because everything is changing all of the time, and it makes it difficult to kind of lay out what exactly is going to happen in the near future when you're not even entirely sure what's happening now or what's going to happen even in the next few hours. So there's a sense that the more stability, the better, because it kind of lessens the number of moving parts that Israel has to contend with as it sets up its strategy.
That makes sense. So I'm curious then, I think the biggest sort of point of contention for a lot of people is Egypt, because the fear at the extreme is that the Morsi government is going to get rid of Camp David, and then there's from that extreme there's lesser extremes, renegotiate or leverage the Camp David Accords to sort of do to push for more rights for the Palestinians. But how is Israel sort of dealing with the Morsi government, on the regards of the Camp David Accords? Like, how does, this is very much a, one of the key, security architecture and, not contracts, treaties, of the last 20th century, and it seems like it might be at risk.
Absolutely, yeah. So the 1978 Camp David Accords, which were signed between Menachem Begin from Israel and Anwar Sadat from Egypt, have been really one of the major, major tenets of Israel's foreign policy, of the Israel-Egypt relationship. And so there's been considerable concern in Israel that the new government in Egypt might alter some of the terms of the treaty or might seek to renegotiate it in ways that could damage Israeli security. In terms of how these negotiations, or in terms of how this dynamic has actually played out, things have been pretty good. My sense is that most of the coordination is on the security level, so the Egyptian military and the Israel Defense Forces. And a good example of this is back in 2011, when there was an attack from the Sinai at Eilat, or right outside Eilat. The Egyptian government asked Israel to move the line at which the Camp David Accords limits how far into the Sinai Egyptian troops can go. And Israel actually agreed to do this and called it sort of a temporary relief or temporary suspension of the rules. And so here you have the Israeli government trusting the Egyptian military establishment enough that it's willing to alter the terms of the Camp David Accords to consent to this particular change in order to allow those forces to come in and sort of establish a higher level of security in the Sinai. This remains an ongoing issue, and we've been tracking the story over the past couple of days of an Israeli citizen who was kidnapped by Bedouin in the Sinai. The entity negotiating for his release, again, is the Egyptian security forces. So on that level, things seem to be relatively stable, and there's also an understanding in Egypt that good relations with Israel is one of the major tenets for continuing to receive foreign aid from the United States. So Israel receives the most defense aid of any country from the U.S., but the number two country is Egypt, and that's largely because of the Camp David Accords. With regards to the Morsi government specifically and the Brotherhood, there are internal divisions in the Brotherhood. The old guard, I believe, tends to be more conservative. The younger generation may be a bit more liberal. And within the governing establishment itself, that is to say Morsi and his compatriots, and maybe to a lesser extent the Freedom and Justice Party, the FJP, there's an understanding that when the rubber meets the road, you have responsibility. So it's not only about rhetoric, but it's about action. And we've seen a pretty substantial shift in President Morsi's rhetoric looking, you know, before back in 2010, where a video came out where he was describing Jews as apes and pigs, and this was a very controversial example of the radical positions that he was willing to go on the record with. Since becoming the president, that rhetoric has really been toned down, and when people ask him about some of his earlier comments, he's really been kind of backing off. And the reason for that is that he understands that on the one hand, you have to maintain a domestic constituency, but on the other hand, there's also a country to run. And especially given the economic turmoil that Egypt is in and its attempt to secure loans from the IMF, there are more important issues than trying to gain a constituency by alienating Israel, which will only hurt Egypt in the long run.
So, and then I'm curious then, how does the dynamic work that if Israel is, they have a better partnership with the military side of things, and not the civilian side? I mean, isn't the implication that, you know, the civilian side isn't really, you know, foreign relations is really a matter of a civilian government as opposed to a military government, or the military portion of the government? So, I mean, how has that affected the dynamic in general? You know, not just looking at the Sinai or looking at, you know, cooperation, military cooperation. I mean, how is that, you know, it seems like, you know, Israel's just really, you know, relying on its old connections as opposed to making new ones.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
yeah, I mean, I think that to some extent, this is a new structure in Egypt, given President Mubarak's, you know, very close alignment with the Air Force, his affiliations with the military. There was a lot of contention over Israeli politics in Israel and an incident a year or so ago where the Israeli embassy in Cairo was stormed. I believe there's now a staff that's returned, and I believe also this week the first Israeli foreign ministry delegation to Egypt just came for a visit. So there's a slow process of trying to build ties. To some extent, it will be difficult because there are sources of grievances. The 1973 war, for example, remains a very sensitive issue between Egyptians and Israelis. But at the same time, we're moving in this direction not only with regards to Israeli policy, but really all states in the region, that after the Arab Spring, there's been a renewed focus or a greater importance for not only militaries and governments, but really for people as well. And so this will require a more holistic approach for all governments in the region, including Israel. So because of the magnitude of the sea changes that we've seen in the region, these are likely not things that are going to happen overnight. There's a lot of mistrust. There's a lot of concern about the direction that the Morsi government and other elements within other post-transition countries may take things.
So then, you made a good point about the Sinai, but would you say that there's sort of mutual ground or mutual sort of cooperation in regards to sort of, you know, the situation at Sinai? So for people at home, so the Sinai has largely become, I don't know if this is accurate, but it's become sort of very much unregulated and very much, you know, there's very much groups who are in the Sinai, you know, you're basically the ability of Egypt to manage the Bedouins in the Sinai and other groups in the Sinai has receded. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious then, does Israel see, A, the Sinai as a threat, and B, you know, does it see Egypt part of the solution? If there's a solution, you know, rather than just managing it and hoping that Egypt will once again sort of take over the Sinai. Mm-hmm. Not take over, but maintain, you know, create control.
Yeah, so I think the governance issue is really key in the Sinai. Yes, Israel does view the Sinai and the lack of governance there as a threat, and that's for a couple of reasons. The first is that you have Bedouin trafficking that goes on between the Sinai-Israel border. So that includes drugs, it includes people. Human trafficking is a huge issue, and it also includes weapons. And so the transport of weapons into, for example, the Gaza Strip is a major point of concern for Israel, and also for Egypt as well, because when there's tension between Hamas and Israel, that has implications for Egypt, which shares a border with the Gaza Strip, and is also, there's some expectation that they will come in to mediate or in some way to also to stand up for Palestinians who are there. With regards to Egypt being the solution, I think that would be Israel's preferred outcome because the alternative would be an IDF operation in the Sinai, in Egypt, which would be extremely awkward, probably not in Israel's interest. And there's a shared interest in Egypt and Israeli security in the Sinai, that this space is ungoverned, but that has implications both for the strength of the Egyptian government as well as the Israeli government. And so we've seen a lot of coordination on that particular issue. Also on the issue of Gaza, back in November, the ceasefire agreement brokered between Hamas and Israel was mediated largely by the Egyptian government.
So then, would you say that sort of, you know, a positive development is that, you know, even though you, you know, Morsi, you know, has a constituency that not that isn't necessarily, you know, very Israel positive on Israel, but his constituency would also sort of say, you know, we do, Egypt does want to be more involved in a Palestinian sort of settlement or negotiations or whatever, you know, that would lead to sort of the Morsi government, you know, conceptualizing its role, you know, between the Palestinians and the Israelis as, you know, a mediator or a negotiator, you know, in contrast to Mubarak, who basically said, you know, who always sided with, you know, the Israeli government, you know, and always against, you know, the Palestinians, you know, or is that, you know, sort of, or is that way off? Like,
well, my sense is that the amount of pressure that any Egyptian government will be under to try and move the Palestinian statehood process forward, to try to improve the situation for Palestinians, will be higher. And that's, again, because sub-state groups have taken a much more prominent role in politics in the Middle East in general. With regards to how the Morsi government will be handling that, I think to some extent they're interested in that, but again, there are so many other pressing issues like the economy in Egypt, and again, because the international community plays such an important role in that process, that it's a very delicate balancing act. So I have no doubt that there is a sizable constituency within the pro-Morsi camp that would like to see, you know, renegotiation of the peace treaty or a more assertive Egyptian stance on Palestinians. I think in general, the Egyptian public, even those who are not aligned with Morsi specifically, have legitimate concerns about the state of Palestinians, the state of Palestinian life in Gaza. And sooner or later, that will come to play a role in the Egypt-Israel relationship. So this is really sort of a critical moment in which the two sides working together to try and formulate a post Mubarak policy have some opportunities to try and find areas where collusion is even more possible now than maybe it would have been before, shifting to that new reality on the ground.
So let's switch gears a bit and go towards Syria. So Egypt was, you know, the revolution was, I don't want to say clean, but it wasn't, it didn't contribute to a war. It didn't become a war, it didn't become an insurgency, and didn't become a, you know, a big cluster mess, you know, it didn't, you know, it was relatively, it was anything you would expect from a revolutionary government, you know, sort of that transition from Mubarak to Morsi. But with Syria, though, you know, it's become a war. It's, you know, undoubtedly has become an insurgency, a civil war, whatever, you know, academic, you know, you want to attach to it. So I'm curious then, you know, A, you know, let's start with, you know, what is Israel's view of the Syrian conflict? You know, because, you know, for some of us, you know, as students of Middle Eastern history, we see that, you know, this, in the 80s, you had something similar in Syria where you had a Muslim Brotherhood uprising, an insurgency, you know, and that, you know, at the tail end of that insurgency, it sort of contributed to the Lebanese civil war, which then, you know, drew in Israel and sort of became a huge mess for years and years to come. So I'm curious then, you know, what is Israel's view of the situation in Syria? Mm-hmm. You know, as not necessarily as an intelligence problem, but as a foreign policy problem.
Sure. Yeah. So it's actually shifted a bit over time. Back when the violence first broke out in Syria, there was some reluctance to call for President Assad to step down. And the rationale behind that was that he's sort of the devil you know versus the devil you don't know. So there's a sense that while obviously Bashar Assad is not one of the more pro-Israel leaders, that he is motivated by Syrian self-interest. The major point of contention between Israel and Syria is the Golan Heights, which is a resource, a physical issue. And so it's unclear kind of who would come in to replace him. President Assad, his actions, the Israeli defense establishment would say it could be more or less predicted, but whoever came in next would be sort of a new set of preferences, a blank slate. Now there's an understanding in Israel that President Assad will step down sooner or later, and there's support for that, and looking towards the future for what a post-Assad Syria will look like. Now, that's been sort of a hypothetical and more esoteric conversation in the United States and the rest of the international community, but in Israel, because it's a conflict that's happening on the border, there's sort of a much more pressing element right to it. So Israel's response has largely been to delineate red lines. So the first red line is that if IDF positions in the Golan receive fire from Syrian forces, that they'll fire back. And we saw an example of this just this morning. It's happened a few times before. And the other red line is that if Israel has intelligence that there are weapons, particularly chemical weapons going through Syria to Hezbollah and Lebanon, that that's a red line as well. And so the strike that we saw back right in earlier this year, earlier in 2013, was a good example of that. So Israel has its red lines that it wants to enforce, but it's not going to cross those, and these are sort of tripwires versus a more offensive kind of policy.
So then I'm curious then, sort of, you know, it seems that, you know, to your point, you know, Assad was the devil you know, but moreover, you know, you've spent the last, you know, 20, 30 years establishing relationships. And when I say relationships, I don't mean that in a positive way. That's, you know every guy in the foreign ministry, you know every guy in the defense ministry, and you've developed a, you know, a very strong asset list, you know, in terms of both foreign policy, defense policy, and intelligence. But it seems like, you know, with the FSA, you know, a lot of the personalities in the FSA and then Jabhat al-Nusra and, you know, all these, you know, other organizations that sort of compose, you know, this catch-all opposition, they're not familiar to anybody. And I wonder, you know, is that the same feeling for the Israelis, that really the FSA, you know, they might be fighting Assad, but they're really unknowns, especially, you know, if you, you know, on a, you know, superficial examination, there are sort of Islamist trends and sort of, you know, the idea that a lot of these guys don't have a problem merging politics with sort of a more conservative, more Salafi, whatever interpretation of Islam. I mean, is there a worry there that, you know, for, you know, an unknown is coming to power, and then it's an unknown that will probably have problems with Israel? Or is that something being discussed, or?
I think there's an assumption that whoever comes to power in a post-Assad Syria will probably not be particularly friendly to Israel, and that's sort of a given. The added point of concern, and I think the more the bigger moving part or the larger variable is the question of Islamist groups and the extent to which organizations like Jabhat al-Nusra will have an influence on what happens in Syria, and to some extent the role of Islamists in Egypt, the role of parties like Ennahda in Tunisia, and Salafists, and the way that the preferences of these particular parties will affect the foreign policy of what have previously been countries under secular rule. And so the major point of concern here is that if the leader is what Israel would understand to be rational, motivated by self-interest, motivated by material resources, then the security strategy is essentially deterrence. So you make it not worth their while to start any kind of conflict. The issue that Israel sees with Islamist groups is that Islamist leaders, you know, because there's sort of a religious influence there, it's a different set of preferences. So there's a fear that, you know, if it's a Sunni Islamist, that there will be sort of this desire to, you know, establish the global caliphate. If it's a Shia, then, you know, to take action to hasten the return of the Mahdi. And so these are very different kinds of preferences that make it really difficult. I would say particularly with regards to Jabhat al-Nusra and also with regards to Iran, there's a sense that people calling the shots in Iran are not sort of motivated by real politique, but rather by, you know, starting a conflict that will sort of hasten the end of days and things like that. And so that presents a lot of uncertainty for Israel, and I think is the cause of a lot of concern and a lot of sleepless nights in the defense establishment.
Then I'm curious to sort of extend on what you said, that, you know, there's a difference between, you know, a rational Islamist and somebody who's more influenced by, you know, an extremist interpretation of their religion. What about Turkey? I mean, would you argue, or would you say that sort of Turkey falls into the more rational? I mean, sort of Erdogan, you know, the whole ruling, I think it's the AKP, my Turkish politics is a little shaky, but, you know, most of those guys are Islamists, and those guys sort of, their constituency was basically, you know, very much similar, you know, their constituency development and how they came to power was very much, you know, in parallel to the Muslim Brotherhood, in the sense that, you know, social work, doing well with your constituency, and then slowly, you know, working your way up, you know, even though, you know, the establishment doesn't want you to be elected. But, you know, sort of walk us through sort of Israel's recent relationship with Turkey. You know, how does that, you know, we saw yesterday or on Friday that Bibi, you know, apologized for the flotilla incident. You know, I don't know if the apology was sincere or was it, you know, just him sort of, you know, saying whatever, but, you know, sort of walk us through that recent sort of relationship with Turkey.
Sure, yeah. So I think that came as a surprise to most analysts. And my sense is that given the amount of political capital that the apology required, that it was sincere. Because, right. So, I mean, the previous foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, came out with a statement against the apology, who is the prime minister's coalition or joint list partner in these most recent elections. So it's been a controversial move. With regards to Israel's policy towards Turkey, I think the fact that Turkey has been such a strong secular, historically such a strong secular country, plays a role. And so there's sort of this path-dependent aspect to it. The sort of rational Islamist divide and is sort of mapped onto the secular Islamist divide, I think, as some in the Israeli foreign policy community or defense community think about it. So with regards to Turkey, there's some concern that the rise of an Islamist party like the AKP matters. But at the same time, that's occurring within a framework of secularism and also a framework of having had negotiations, having had interaction with this particular government. You know, at the same time that there are certain similarities maybe between the way the Brotherhood and the AKP came to power, there's also been a substantial conversation here in Washington about the differences between Egypt and Turkey and how a Turkish model is not really realistic for Egypt. So I think the structural differences in both governments there can explain some of those different policies.
But I mean, do you think, you know, I think you hit on something, because I don't think you can take the Turkish model and put it onto the Egyptian model. What I do think is sort of what's useful between the Turkish model and the Egyptian model is that the role of the United States, because it seems, you know, we go through the press, you know, it was sort of Obama or, you know, people in Obama's, you know, State Department or his staff sort of poking Bibi and then sort of poking the Turks, saying, you know, there's a bigger issue here, you know, whether that's, you know, whether that's specifically Syria or Iran or, you know, whatever. It just seems like, you know, the United States does have a role to play as a mediator, especially. I wonder if we could take that and apply that to Egypt, or is that, do you think it's so, Egypt is so, you know, different in terms of its politics and in terms of its relationship with the United States, that that role isn't possible?
Well, I think the role does play a substantial part in explaining that. I mean, also, you know, Turkey and Israel haven't fought a war, whereas Egypt and Israel have fought multiple wars. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's the history of the relationship that plays a strong role. But certainly U.S. involvement, U.S.-Turkish relations matter considerably in Israel's calculus. The Netanyahu government and the prime minister himself have really fingered the issue of Syria as the reason for the apology. And they say, look, when there's such a crisis going on both of our borders, we need to be able to communicate, and we have a more important issue here. So we need to, you know, settle our bad blood on the Gaza flotilla incident and really focus on what's happening now, which has impacted Turkey with the flow of refugees, and I believe that exchange of fire that's gone back and forth between Syria and Turkey as well. So that seems to be the issue that the prime minister wants to really focus on. But I think you're right to say that the role of the United States is impacting that decision as well.
So then sort of switch one more gear and sort of say, what about Israel's relationship with the Gulf monarchies? You know, the Gulf monarchies seem really, I don't want to say unchanged, but like there was protests in Saudi Arabia, there was protests definitely in Bahrain, and there was protests in Oman, and it just seems like the Saudis were able to bribe their way through it, the Bahrainis were able to beat their way through it, and the Omanis, you know, sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, you know, whatever. But, you know, what is, you know, Israel's relationship with the Gulf? Because this also seems like a mystery to me as somebody who's studied the Middle East, but could never really, like, I can't remember a book or a paper that I read dealing with Israel's relationship to the Gulf that wasn't about oil. So mm-hmm. that was actually about foreign policy or national interest. So sort of walk us through that. I mean, it would seem that KSA would be, you know, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia would seem really against Israel, but then again, you know, democracy really doesn't play that much of a role in Saudi Arabia, so.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that you haven't read very much, because my dissertation will be looking at the Gulf states and also Israel, so
yes.
I'm glad to hear I have a niche. The relationship, there is a relationship, and there are countries where, you know, Israelis can travel in the Gulf. It's sort of very a little bit here, a little bit there, and at the same time that there are relationships most likely related to sort of non-political kinds of things, like agriculture, for example, there is, in fact, a relationship, and my sense is that that could play an important role as the tensions between Iran and Israel kind of play out over the next few years. With regards to Israel and Saudi Arabia, my sense is that on the surface there is animosity, but there's less so under the table.
Right.
And so there's been talk that if Israel were to strike Iran and use Saudi airspace, it would probably be condemned officially by Saudi Arabia, but they would probably allow it to happen. There's a base in northern Saudi Arabia that has, I believe, they're F-16s. They're in relatively close proximity to Israel, so I know that's one of the threats that they're looking out for. But my sense is that you have sort of Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Israel as sort of the three regional hegemons, and that Saudi Arabia and Israel they share a joint interest in trying to check Iranian power, because Saudi Arabia is Sunni versus Iran, which is Shia, and Israel because of the sort of nuclear issue that Israel is afraid of.
I'm curious then, how does Turkey play into that dynamic? Because, you know, Turkey, you know, for the longest time they had that no problems, you know.
The zero problems strategy.
Zero problems, yeah. Not no problems. And, you know, what I've noticed, especially sort of going through Iran, that Turkey really does have, I don't want to say good relations with Iran, but on a sub-state level there is definitely a very, you know, robust financial relationship with Iran. But I'm curious then, where do we put Turkey in between, you know, Israel, KSA, and Iran? Because, you know, Turkey seems to have relationships with all three, because, you know, Turkey really wants to, you know, not be friends, but have a good relationship with Israel. KSA, you know, invests heavily in Turkey, you know, billions of dollars. And then Iran, you know, sort of Turkey has, for the longest time, has been a real, you know, sizable conduit of, not money laundering, but sort of moving gold and moving money from Iran to Turkey, and then repatriating that money back into Iran. So I'm curious then, you know, where does Turkey fall in this model? And then, you know, does Israel really, you know, rely on Turkey, or does it sort of, you know, what's the dynamic there?
Mm-hmm. I think the best way to understand Turkey's position in the region is to step back even further and look at Turkey as a nexus between the West and the European community, the United States, and the Middle East on the other hand. Josh Walker, who is at the German Marshall Fund, talks about how Turkey has one eye looking to the East and one eye looking to the West, and really seeks to serve as a key mediator between a lot of these disputes. So at the same time that there are close ties with Iran, it's in Turkey's interest to also have close ties with Saudi Arabia and Israel, because it gives Turkey more political capital when Western powers are trying to advance their strategic interests. And so to the extent that Turkey can do that, it solidifies its importance as a regional hegemon as well, and can sort of, return to its sort of sense of Ottoman power and desire to really have an influence over the politics in the region. With regards to Israel, the Turkey-Israel relationship has been sort of muted over the past few years. The Gaza flotilla incident was not the first example of strained ties between the two countries, but there is an understanding that Turkey, as a relatively secular government, as a place that has an abundance of water, which is a really important resource issue in Israel, that over the long term there's an interest in having a good relationship. And my sense is that that's a mutual feeling in Turkey as well, that at the same time that there's been sort of a very contentious issue over the flotilla incident, that in general Turkey has a lot to gain from having a good relationship with Israel too.
Okay, so to sort of last question for our foreign policy section, you know, does Israel have a Islamist policy? I mean, it seems that, you know, with the Arab Spring, and then, you know, let's throw in Hezbollah, Hamas, Iran, and then, you know, with the sort of the rise of the sort of Arab Islamists in Egypt, Tunisia, you know, and those places, and in Syria, you know, does Israel have a, you know, an Islamist policy? You know, are there Islamists that, you know, you've sort of touched on this, you know, rational versus sort of extremist, you know, does the Foreign Office, the Defense Ministry, do they have a sort of Islamist policy? You know, are there Islamists that they talk to? Are there Islamists they don't talk to? Or is it really, you know, sitting there and evaluating, you know, each case and saying, you know, they're rational, you know, they clearly have an interest, you know, their interests are tied to, you know, politics, policy, and material, as opposed to, you know, God, you know, a extreme interpretation of, you know, faith.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to know the answer to that question. But my sense is the division is Islamist parties versus Islamist insurgencies. So there's a difference when we're talking about the Brotherhood or Ennahda on the one hand, and talking about Hamas and Hezbollah, which have carried out terror attacks against Israeli civilians, and which remain very serious sources of threat to Israel, both in the short term and also in the long term. So with regards to parties, I think there's sort of a wait and see approach. See if there might be opportunities, see what they do, see the extent to which these parties are taking a very proactive anti-Israel line, the extent to which that impacts the relationship between Israel and governments. But with regards to groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, there's a sense of a very severe threat. And what's interesting is that the defense establishment actually talks about its policy in terms of deterrence, being able to deter Hamas and Hezbollah, and justifying entering the Gaza Strip or entering southern Lebanon under reestablishing deterrence with these groups. So there's sort of a different set of inputs that come into that foreign policy calculation.
So would you say that it has a lot to do with violence then? I mean, it seems that Hezbollah and Hamas are active, if not, you know, constant threats, whereas, you know, Morsi, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is, you know, it's more rhetoric than physical action. I mean,
exactly.
Do you think the model sort of, you know, it's hinged on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a sense that political parties that are Islamist could be a threat in the future, whereas armed groups like Hamas and Hezbollah are threats right now. Yeah, yeah.
So let's switch gears to domestic politics. So Israel, they had elections, what, a couple months ago?
January 22nd.
January 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so basically walk us through who won and why did they win. So this is, so for people who, for a little background, this, it's a parliamentary system. So it's, you know, doesn't have the robust simplicity that they have in the United States. But then again, anybody looking at the United States system would say that it's a huge cluster, you know, a mess. So just walk us through, you know, who are the, you know, who won and what are the parties, what were the sort of platforms they ran on?
Because sure. Yeah. So the winning party was actually two parties that ran on a joint list, which was the Likud party, which is a center-right secular party under the leadership of Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the Yisrael Beitenu party, which is a more far-right party led by Avigdor Lieberman.
Okay, so, I'm sorry, I don't mean to stop. So define, like, when you say, you know, what does the right look like in Israel? So so first, like, Likud, like, is, like, are they more nationalist, less nationalist now, or that's more Lieberman's party?
Yes, this is actually a really important point of clarification. Okay. So thanks for raising that. Yeah.
Sorry.
So in the United States, we think about politics as sort of a two-dimensional arena. So you have social issues and economic issues, and you can be more liberal and conservative on each of those. So I'm from suburban Boston, and there are people there. There's a constituency who is socially liberal, supports gay marriage, supports abortion rights, things like that, but is relatively conservative on economic issues, supports less government spending, reducing the number of people on welfare. So it's a two-dimensional space. In Israel, it's a three-dimensional space because you have social issues, economic issues, and religious issues.
Okay.
And so the religious secular spectrum plays another role, and it complicates the policy space because you can have a party like United Torah Judaism, which is conservative in terms of its religious position. It's an Orthodox party. With regards to social issues, is sort of right, but not really extreme right. And in some ways, with regards to economic policies, is liberal in terms of supporting payouts to yeshiva students and things like that. So it makes for a more complicated space. And this is in some ways a curse because it complicates things, in some ways a blessing because it gives you another access to try and find consensus on if you're the prime minister. And so that's a huge part of what he or she is doing.
So back to who won. So you have Likud, you have Israel Beitenu, the Lieberman's party, and now who's the rest of the coalition?
Yeah, okay, so the Likud Beitenu joint list won 31 seats out of 120 total in the Knesset. So the next really big winner was the Yesh Atid party, which is led by Yair Lapid, who is a former journalist. Sort of like the, in some ways, the Anderson Cooper or the Wolf Blitzer of Israel. He has a talk show, just sort of like mid like 50s guy who sort of portrayed himself as someone in someone concerned about the future of Israel and sort of took a centrist kind of pragmatist line. And so there was a sense that because he was kind of a newcomer onto the political scene in this last round of elections, because he didn't have that much experience, and because he didn't really have a natural constituency, that he wouldn't do particularly well. And I believe the last poll before the elections had the Yesh Atid party polling at around 11 seats out of 120. In the actual election, the Yesh Atid party picked up 19 seats.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah, so this is almost twice as many as people had expected. And their popularity actually went up during the coalition negotiation process. And so that's because the Yesh Atid party is largely focused on economic reform, kind of coming off of the social movement protests that we saw in Israel back in 2011 and to a lesser extent in 2012.
So the social movement... So, was it sort of like, I hate using, you know, parallels, but like Occupy Wall Street, or was it sort of deeper than that? Like I know Occupy Wall Street, you know, it's, I'm using it not as specifics, but sort of as an analogous. So what were the, you know, what is the basis of the left in Israel now? I mean, now I was under the impression that labor had sort of, I don't want to say died, but, you know, labor isn't necessarily... the biggest, most popular party, or, you know, tenants of the Labour Party, or tenants of the left.
Yeah, so I think there are some people who draw those connections between Occupy Wall Street and the protest movement, which went under the hashtag J14. But the major difference was that the Occupy Wall Street movement was a more liberal movement. The social protests were largely cross-cutting in Israel. You had people who were liberal, people who were moderate, and people who were conservative. So I was actually in Israel during 2011 in the summer, going to different protest camps and interviewing people as part of some research that I was doing. And I was staying with some pretty conservative colleagues of mine, and I was excited because this would be sort of a negative case, and I could ask them about why they were opposed to the protests and why they thought they were a waste of time. And so they mentioned the protests, and I asked, oh, so, you know, did you go to the protests? And they said, yeah, of course we went to the protests. And I was shocked that these, you know, pretty conservative colleagues would be willing to, you know, drive down to Tel Aviv and participate in this movement. But it was pretty substantial, and there was one march that had, I believe, 300,000 people in Tel Aviv, whose population is about 410,000. So this is a pretty significant subset of the population, and it really cut across these cleavages. Now, over time, that's kind of died down a little bit. So in the last summer's protests, there was a much more kind of leftist bent onto what was going on. But this was really kind of a centrist movement, and the premise was that the state had been moving too far towards privatization, and that it hadn't really been taking care of its citizens. The phrase that I heard a lot of people in the camps use was, my children can't finish out the month, that they just don't have enough money to make it on a month-to-month basis.
Wow.
The cost of housing was really high, and just all these other kind of issues. Now, you also had smaller groups that sort of tacked onto them. So in Be'er Sheva, the protest camp had a sizable component of Bedouin activists who were sort of pushing for Bedouin issues. You had, you know, certain sort of anti-capitalist movements and, you know, some sort of interests that kind of tried to tag along to these. There was this, like, Venus Project on Rothschild Boulevard that I'm not even sure what they stood for. So a lot of interests that tagged on. But the core of the movement was reasonable Israelis who otherwise wouldn't have come out to protest, but who were sort of sick of the status quo and saw an opportunity to move forward. And that's, I think, the most important thing about the J14 movement. It wasn't that, I mean, there was a Trachtenberg Commission, which was government leaders who would come to the protest camps, meet with people sort of town hall style. They developed a set of recommendations that were implemented. But the, you know, the bigger importance of the movement is that people often talk about the Israeli public as a very cynical population, including Israelis themselves. And that's a very kind of popular thing to say, you know, in interviews or in DC think tank events. But the J14 movement really demonstrates that when Israelis are presented with a viable alternative to the status quo, that they are willing to take the necessary actions to try and make that happen, and that they support that kind of progress forward. So in the long term, that's a very important dynamic. And so sort of moving back to the question of the new government, that's something that Yair Lapid and a lot of other members of the coalition capitalized on. So the fourth party was the Bayat Yehudi party, the Jewish Home Party, and that's led by Naftali Bennett, who formerly worked for Prime Minister Netanyahu. It's a religious Zionist party, which is a relatively new development in Israel in terms of ideology. But Naftali Bennett is in many ways also kind of bridging between different constituencies, and I think that's kind of the trend among people who won in the last election. They kind of bridged these constituencies. So Naftali Bennett is very popular among the settler movement, and he wears a head covering, a kippah. But at the same time, his background is as a software tycoon. He kind of dresses like you would expect someone to dress in Tel Aviv. He has a smartphone. And so he kind of bridges this gap between the secular religious divide. Yair Lapid kind of bridges a gap in terms of sticking to principles and believing in the basic tenets of the state, while at the same time taking kind of a pragmatic view towards how to solve those principles. So he sits in kind of the center where the Israeli median voter is as well.
So then, who are the losers of the election? You know, in the newspaper, you know, they were quick to, I think it was in the NewsHour or New York Times, I don't know, somewhere, where they mentioned that the Orthodox parties, you know, it's the first time in 10 years that they hadn't been included in coalition building. So walk us through that. I mean, that seems to be a big, I mean, my understanding of it, it's really superficial, but that's a big issue that, you know, across all these elections, they've been included, now suddenly they've sort of been pushed out. How does that work with what you've told us, you know, previously?
Yeah, so I would agree. I think the biggest loser was probably the Shas party, which is a religious party with a sort of Mizrahi and Mizrahi affiliation, which are Jews from Arab countries, but an Orthodox party. And yes, this is the first time in about 10 years they haven't been included in the coalition. It's also significant because historically the Israeli political system was a dominant party system that was led by Mapai, which was the sort of precursor to Labor, eventually merged with the Labor Party in 1968. But so the way they were able to form a coalition was an agreement between David Ben-Gurion back in the 1940s and religious parties, in which religious parties were put in charge of a lot of the architecture of the state, and in particular a lot of the civil ministry. So traditionally, the head of the education ministry has been someone who's religious. The Orthodox run the civil establishments like marriage, which is one reason that many Israelis get married in Turkey or Cyprus, because the marriage has to be an Orthodox marriage in order to be recognized by the state if it takes place in Israel. So there's a very strong Orthodox influence. This plays into the issue of military conscription because there are exemptions for students who study in yeshiva. So the fact that this group is out is relatively significant. They are not very happy about it, and they were pushing really hard to get into the coalition. So now there's a lot of bitterness between the prime minister and the Shas party, but they have been in the opposition before. And while I'm not sure there's that much alignment between the platforms of the Labor Party, which is the major opposition party under the leadership of Shelly Achimovich, another former journalist, there are enough joint interests in wanting to counter the policy of the prime minister that they may be able to gain some traction in the next coming years or so.
So what should we expect from, you know, the new coalition? You know, what are the implications for domestic and foreign policy? Because it seems, you know, Netanyahu has a very much, you know, I'll characterize it as a very sort of, you know, outward strong foreign policy, strong in the sense that, you know, deterrence and won't let Iran get a nuclear weapon, you know, and, you know, very much, you know, oh, I guess it's radio, so they can't see it, but very much shaking his fist at, you know.
Sinan's literally shaking his fist right
now. Outside of, you know, okay, people who are against Israel. But, you know, I think a lot of our audience forgets that, you know, Bibi was very much, you know, a capitalist. You know, he was very much in the 90s sort of pushing for away from socialism, away from the left, and into, I guess, broadly, you know, Thatcher, Reagan sort of capitalism and privatization and sort of, you know, moving Israel into what we see, what is it today, which is, you know, very much this powerhouse in technology and very much, you know, an economic powerhouse. So
much to its credit,
you know, it's so walk us through. So how does this, what are the implications, especially since also Lieberman's party is included, and sort of Lieberman strikes me as very much, you know, kind of a, you know, an ass when it comes to foreign policy, because he seems very much, you know, being able to alienate everybody and everything by saying, by being very ultra-nationalistic. Very nationalistic and very sort of, you know, without, you know, not charisma, but tact. So, I mean, how does this jumble work in terms of FP and, you know, domestic policy?
Sure. I think there are sort of three dynamics to keep in mind. So the first is that the prime minister has made a gamble in terms of who he's put in what ministry. So the foreign ministry is being held open for Foreign Minister Lieberman, who's currently under indictment,
right.
Is expected to return back to serve in that position. But so Yair Lapid has been put in charge of the finance ministry, in charge of the treasury, and Tzipi Livni has been put in charge of the justice ministry, but also in charge of Israel's relationship with Palestinians and the status of Palestinian negotiations. And what's significant about that is that these are major campaign issues on which Tzipi Livni and Yair Lapid made their campaign. So there's some risk in that they're now being put into positions where they have a lot of opportunity to make a difference. The reason that the prime minister is making that gamble is because these problems are, it's a lot easier to campaign about them than it is to actually fix them. And
right.
Just today, Yair Lapid was trying to sort of brace the Israeli public for the fact that over the next year, Israel needs to cut spending by about $3.5 billion.
I'm sorry, what? $3.5 billion?
It has to reduce its planned spending by 13 billion shekels, so about $3.6 billion. So this is a significant issue, and people
right.
tend not to like it when you stop giving them money. So I think a lot of the rhetoric you've seen from President Obama, you might see a lot of that reflected in the kinds of statements that Yair Lapid is making, that this change doesn't happen overnight, that it's a long-term process. But to the extent that the prime minister can focus the ire of the public on now Minister Lapid, it will sort of diminish his ability to threaten the prime minister in the next round of elections.
Oh, that's sneaky.
And the same for Tzipi Livni, that, you know, assuming she makes progress with Palestinians, then that might maybe help her in the next round of elections. But I think the realistic approach is that that's not particularly likely in the course of the next Netanyahu administration. The second dynamic relates to Naftali Bennett from the Habayat Yehudi party, and he's really been a mover and a shaker in the past elections. Yesh Atid has come up after the elections as a really important and really key factor, but even beforehand, people were looking at Naftali Bennett and that party as a major source of political change and a major force to be reckoned with. And one of the reasons that's the case is because you have an alignment to some extent between Israel Beitenu, which has religious Zionist tones, and Habayat Yehudi, and also the Likud party itself is pretty wide. So just as with, you know, the Democrats in the United States, you have your kind of center, you know, sort of like Hillary Clinton style Democrats, and then your more progressive Democrats kind of further out, like your Dennis Kuciniches. Then in the Republican side, you have your more like centrists, you know, kind of like your Lindsey Grahams, and then your like far out like Rand Paul Tea Party Republicans. So you have splits within the party, and it's the same with Likud. So the prime minister is relatively centrist and part of sort of the Reuven Rivlin, Netanyahu kind of centrist, although those two do not get along. They have some very bad blood over the fact that Rivlin was sort of kicked out of being the speaker of the Knesset. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have a sort of conservative wing, which is headed up by Dani Danon and Tzipi Hotoveli, who are both very conservative and very energetic, relatively young ministers in the Knesset. And their ability to cause an insurrection within the Likud party is bolstered by the fact that Naftali Bennett is in the party. And so there's a very strong far-right contingent that has the opportunity to make a lot of political problems for the prime minister. And so his ability to manage that will be a key dynamic and will also motivate a lot of the decisions that he makes. So if he tacks towards the far right on certain issues, then one of the reasons why may be because he's waning in political capital with that particular constituency. The final dynamic, I mean, I think that this kind of relates to the rise of international scrutiny that we've seen with regards to Israel and some of the challenges that it's faced. We've seen this play a really strong role over even just the past 6 to 8 months or so in Operation Pillar of Defense, when Israel received criticism before it had even actually mounted a ground invasion. And so dealing with this international pressure, especially with regards to other issues like the Palestinian statehood bid, which are largely trying to leverage international support, the way that Israel reacts to these is really important. And I know there's an understanding within the Israeli Foreign Ministry, but there's mixed understandings and disagreement about how exactly the foreign posture of Israel should be set up. So, the foreign minister represents a relatively sizable constituency of people in Israel who say, look, the international community has never really supported Israel, historically has never supported Jews. We've seen centuries of oppression, we've seen the Holocaust, and so we are going to do what we need to do to protect Israel's security.
Right.
And if the international community has a problem with that, then I think they've demonstrated before that, reliance on them is not a smart policy for Israel. So rather have the international community not like us but still exist versus being nice and ceding significant ground that harms our ability to be a secure state. And so that's a widely understood position for many people in Israel. And so the debate that goes on in foreign policy is not necessarily just a small niche of people, but comes back to this fundamental concern based on Israel's history, based on the history of Zionism, the history of Jews as a nation, and has a very strong impact on where that constituency seeks to take Israeli foreign policy into the future.
So for a sort of last question, series of questions, I'm curious then, has the Arab Spring come to domestic Israeli politics? So I'm not talking about, Syrians or Egyptians, but Arab Israelis. How do Arab Israelis play into the dynamics that you've discussed? And, how do they play into politics? How do they play into the military? How does this dynamic work? Because I'm curious because it really seems, my popular understanding, not popular in the sense of everybody endorses it, but popular in the sense that, my superficial sort of read is, they're sort of the out group, they have rights, they have a party, but it's sort of, it's not what you would consider mainstream. So sort of walk us through that. How does that work? And then, what is their relationship, if any, to the larger Arab Spring or any civil rights movement, for that matter?
Sure. So that sounds like two kind of separate questions.
Oh, sorry.
So the first is the role of Arab Israelis in Israel, and the second is the impact of the Arab Spring. So with regards to the first question, I think you're generally right that there is legal equality for Israeli Arabs. They are citizens of Israel. They have the protections of Israeli law. An Arab Israeli was just voted as the winner on a major reality TV show in Israel. The consul general in San Francisco is a Bedouin. So there's integration at the legal and governmental level. There are 11 seats in the current Knesset held by a combination of different Israeli Arab parties. The sort of addendum to that is that there are ways in which de facto there are inequalities that persist between Arab Israelis as a minority and traditionally Jewish members of the state. And this kind of maps onto center-periphery relations. But so there are sort of different allocations of resources and different opportunities. And some of this comes back to the issue of IDF military service. So Israel had kind of a divide and conquer policy towards Arabs after it established independence in 1948. And so different groups have different policies. So for the Druze that live mostly in Israel's north, conscription is mandatory. Druze males serve in the military as part of a 1954 agreement. For other Israeli Arabs, service is possible, but not mandatory. So, for example, many Bedouin serve as trackers, which is a way to kind of link up the traditional Bedouin sort of desert nomadic lifestyle and skills that are traditional in that community to stopping human trafficking and drug trafficking, things like that. And so the problem is that you don't have all Arab Israelis who serve in the military, which means that they're often denied preference for things like even university housing. So first priority for dorms goes to people who've completed military service. And also, while people in uniform get respect as being active members of society and participating, after they leave uniform, that sense of community kind of goes away. And it's not only Israeli Arabs, it's something the Ethiopian Jewish community in Israel faces as well. So, you know, there are certainly disparities, but I would also say that this is a widely understood dynamic within Israel and something that's a considerable point of discussion. With regards to the parties, it's difficult because the parties have to be mainstream enough that they're taken seriously by the political establishment, but not so mainstream that they're not taken seriously by their constituency, and in particular Arab youth, who have become increasingly more aligned with Palestinians, as opposed to being aligned with, you know, the internal sort of Bedouin community or the Druze community. And so, again, this is historical. So the Bedouin were sort of fenced off in an area in the Negev until 1966 and put under martial law. They weren't allowed to go into cities unless they obtained permits. And so, you know, this dynamic is much more prevalent in the older generation among younger Israelis, who I think have been most affected by the Arab Spring, which kind of moves into the second part of your question. I think the Arab Spring has only kind of accelerated that process of identification, where Israeli Arabs see Palestinians, they see the kinds of challenges that Palestinians face in their day-to-day lives, and they feel a sense of alignment. But so I've, you know, talked to members of the Bedouin community and asked, you know, how do you define yourself? And the person I was talking to in this one particular instance says, I am an Israeli, Palestinian, Bedouin. And so trying to disentangle that is very complicated. Right. But I think, you know, what this speaks to is the fact that the Israeli Arab population is really at a very important nexus. And so it's important for, you know, the Israeli government and for analysts to understand that alienating that community, there are other options for the community. And so, you know, reconciliation may be a better approach.
But, I mean, do you think the issue becomes then, like, it really seems like with sort of Avigdor Lieberman's rise in national politics, it seems, you know, a couple stories that I've read, he struck me as very much, like, not just a nationalist, but like an ultra-nationalist, to the point where, you know, if, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, like, he supported like loyalty laws, like, sort of, you have to, as an Arab Israeli, you had to, you know, I don't know the specifics, I'm sorry, I sort of blanked that.
For an Arab who wanted to obtain citizenship, they had to swear a loyalty oath, and part of it was recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. And for an indigenous Muslim population to recognize Israel as a Jewish state, it feels to that population as sort of a denial of their identity. Right, and so you have this dynamic, and so the problem is it's not really about, you know, if you force people to swear to God that they really, truly, truly are going to be loyal to Israel, that there's recognition that that's going to happen. It's more, I think in some cases, about trying to expose the differences and trying to expose the legitimacy of being concerned about those cleavages. But the problem is that having things like loyalty oaths only, it doesn't just show the cleavage, it exacerbates the cleavage. And when having these, you know, these key communities on your side, having them as a political asset, as a security asset, as an economic asset, is in your interest. It's important for any Israeli government to be very careful about the impact of any given policy.
But I mean, it seems like the Lieberman sort of went out of his way, because if I understand his constituency correctly, it's mostly Eastern Europeans and sort of very much, there's a comfort within that constituency of, you know, towing the line between nationalism, healthy nationalism, and what you would consider ethnocentric, you know, nationalism, and even, you know, outright racism. So it seems that, you know, Like, it almost seems he went out of his way to sort of alienate and to sort of antagonize Arab Israelis in the sense that, you know, either as a way of, you know, a cynical way of, you know, shoring up his constituency or whether he actually believes, you know, those ideas.
Mm. So Foreign Minister Lieberman himself is from Moldova originally. A large number of his constituents and a large number of his members of Knesset are Russian in origin. And it's important to keep in mind that these are constituents who grew up under rampant anti-Semitism, who face very, very strong threats, and so who are fundamentally not trusting of people outside of this particular community. And so that sense of a siege mentality or being a diaspora kind of permeates the way that the constituency approaches foreign policy and domestic policy as well. I mean, yeah, so we can talk about the political implications of Zionism until, you know, until time runs out.
I didn't mean it like that. I meant it sort of more sort of as an issue of civil rights and an issue of, not a question of Zionism, but rather, you know, does it pay politically for Lieberman to go out and sort of to make these calls knowing that there's legal protections, but there's, you know, politically that it could be popular. You know, in the same way, like, in the sort of, in the 60s and 50s in the South, you know, it was, you could run, you know, even though you couldn't legally do anything, but you could shore up your local constituency by, you know, fighting, you know, to pick, you know, to sort of poke another group, you know, in the sense of, you know, the way that, you know, preferences would be ordered would be winning elections, pleasing the constituency, you know, and sort of going after an out group that necessarily does not form part of that constituency. So my question isn't about Zionism. It's more about, you know, internal politics, sort of, you know, the idea that you can use sort of extreme nationalism or, you know, ethnocentric, whatever, as a way to shore up a constituency. Because, I mean, I'm not really, I really don't want to debate. Like, my issue is not to debate, you know, the core meaning of Zionism, but rather, you know.
Smart, yeah.
You're right.
Well, I mean, my sense is, so the idea when we talk about Yisrael Beitenu being sort of a religious Zionist party, I mean, it relates more to religious justification for Israel's presence in the West Bank, for example. So that's more of the issue. I don't think that there's, I mean, I think that there's really a sense of threat or a sense of encroachment, and that comes from the history of Israel and the history of the members of the party. Right, it's obviously very important to, you know, to be concerned about the state of democracy in Israel, and the Israel Beitenu party has often also gone after NGOs like the New Israel Fund that work to try and improve the status of minorities and Israeli Arabs in the country. Yeah, so I mean, so it's a very difficult issue to kind of puzzle through, and it really comes back to the complexity of trying to be a country which is Jewish, democratic, and secure. And there's so many iterations of how to do that, and so many different ways that you can prioritize one over the other, that it is a sizable constituency, and there are, you know, limitations on Arab rights in Israel, or attitudes, I would say more accurately, about Arabs and Arab rights in Israel that are concerning. But at the same time, there are also many people who understand that there is a need to kind of move past the inequality, and that overall the state of Israel has a lot more to gain from bringing the Israeli-Arab periphery more into in line with the mainstream and giving more economic and political opportunities as a way to move the country forward.
So we're nearing the end of the conversation. So do you have anything, do you have anything else you want to add, or, because I feel like it's been a pretty comprehensive conversation. I mean, I feel like I might have missed something. Or.
The one thing I would add is the issue of military conscription, which was a major point on which the Yesh Atid and Habayat HaYehudi parties formed the coalition. So, as I said before, there is an exemption for Haredim who study in yeshivas, And there's been negotiations over having that constituency serve in the military, because as a community, there's a net loss that the state has investing, because Haredi men often don't work, they often don't have skills that make them employable, and the state gives social welfare payouts for every child that you have. So it's been a matter of concern. There was negotiations over this before the elections with the Tal Law, and it's going to be one of the major issues that the new Israeli government will be looking at. The fact that the Shas party is not in the coalition is a major loss for them, because they won't be able to kind of work from the inside to limit the number of Haredim that are drafted. But currently the agreement, there are about 6,000 Haredim who become eligible every year, and they believe they're going to grant about 1,800 exemptions, which is up from what Yesh Atid wanted, which is about 400. But the bigger issue here is sort of this first step of bridging the secular religious gap by increasing the number of religious Haredim, of sort of ultra-Orthodox and Haredi Israelis who are participating in the military. And this has very deep implications historically, because it's been a dynamic that's been in place since the beginning of the state.
So do you think that has a lot to do with the sort of economic restructuring? I mean, it seems like, or is that purely an issue of just bridging the gap?
So I don't think it has much to do with economic restructuring. It's much more of a social issue, and of trying to increase participation, that people feel like they're going out and serving, they're risking their lives, they're serving at checkpoints where they're being targeted, where, you know, they're fighting in wars. And the Orthodox and religious constituency is in yeshivas, they're in schools, they're praying, they don't always work. And so there's a sense of trying to, you know, having them pay their fair share. The other component to this, of course, is that universal conscription would also mean universal conscription for Israeli Arabs. This would be a very contentious point, especially among a younger generation, which, as I mentioned, is feeling sort of an increased sense of affiliation with you know, other populations, Arab populations outside of Israel. So in some ways it puts pressure on that community as well, but it's much more of a social issue than economic.
So this, the issue of conscription then, I mean, does it work? I mean, would it create a stronger sense of nationalism, or is it more, because it seems like once you go into the military service, then that for an individual, it affords you a different sort of rank in society, that you've served your country, now you could, you know, go on. But I mean, is that dynamic still in Israel, or is it more, you know, as an Israeli Arab or as a Druze or as a Bedouin, you serve, or is it, you know, even a, you know, Orthodox, you serve, and then once you're out, you know, you go back to whatever, you know, I mean, or is it, you know, I mean, how does that dynamic work?
Yeah, so there's some concern about that you would have ultra-Orthodox serving in ultra-Orthodox areas, which may not, or in ultra-Orthodox units, which might not really ingrain them very closely. This is the case with a lot of Bedouin units, which serve together with other Bedouin, but not necessarily with Jewish Israelis. So there is sort of a lot of these different sections and different communities. So it's important, you know, if you're a secular Israeli, to have the sort of bump that IDF service affords if you're looking for a job, you know, in a firm or wherever. But if you're, you know, ultra-Orthodox and you're not looking for that kind of employment, then the incentive structure is a little bit different. So your motivations are going to be a little different. But ultimately, I think it's about a sense that the Orthodox population should sort of pay its fair share and should participate in the responsibility of defending the state just as much as any other group. Now, there are Orthodox who participate through a program called Hezder, where they are in yeshiva, but they're also fighting. And among the ultra-Orthodox who don't participate, their point of view on the issue is that you need to have people who study Jewish law and a Jewish state. And this is just as important as having soldiers that are out defending the state, because what's the point of having a Jewish state of Israel if there aren't people there who understand the laws that are written in the Torah and the fundamental Jewish character of the state? So, you know, it's not to say that there's an argument to be made that they're free riding, but I think the response would be that that they see the work that they do in yeshivas as just as important as military service.
So then how does this military service work in Israel? I mean, you made mention that the Orthodox go to Orthodox units, potentially Arabs go to Arab units. I mean, how does this work when, you know, in terms of service? I mean, would you send Arab, would you send, or, like, let's make it really controversial. Would you send Orthodox units into the West Bank? Or is it, well, I mean, it seems, you know, speaking from a, you know, my background is more, you know, military and intelligence, it just seems like, you know, that would present a huge risk if you, you know, in terms of enforcement, if you, you know, send a unit that is, I would consider have more religious coloring, overt religious coloring, into a situation where that not, you know, that might contribute to the efficiency of the unit, you know, going down. You know, how does this work? I mean, do they have Bedouin units serving in, you know, in Arab communities or in Arab sections, or, you know, sort of enlighten me or help us work through this issue?
I'll do my best. So I know that many of the Bedouin units operate in the Negev, which is where at least the southern Bedouin tend to reside. Not actually sure about the Orthodox units in terms of who's assigned where, but you know, the way that conscription works is you have mandatory conscription for men and women at the age of 18. Men serve for a year longer than women do. And so it's just sort of a rite of passage that every Israeli really participates in. My American friends who go to make Aliyah, I know, who go to obtain Israeli citizenship, I know the ones who are likely to stay because they're the ones who go immediately into the military. And the reason is not that they're, you know, so excited to go and fight wars, or they're just, you know, gung-ho about violence and conflict. It's because service in the IDF is what defines you as being Israeli. And so it's this huge social marker. I'd say during the time that I've been in Israel, the day that I, as an American, felt the least Israeli was on Memorial Day, because everybody knows somebody who's been right. killed. And so to not have that kind of access made me feel very much like an outsider because of the military and the important social role that it plays. And I'd also just point out that the military plays an important political role as well, because it's one of the few institutions that can really look long-term. Because you had what was designed as a dominant party system in Israel that later became competitive after the 1977 elections, the prime minister faces a lot of constant threat. So there's always a chance for a vote of no confidence, and so his time horizon has to be pretty short. But the IDF is one of the only, the only other one would be the Israeli Supreme Court, that can look to the long term. So that motivates a lot of how the IDF operates.
So I guess I have a larger question then. How does the monopoly of force work in Israel, in the sense that, you know, they do have there's a strong, you know, military, there's a strong police force, but how does that work in the sense of, this is sort of controversial, but the settler movement? So is that considered, you know, how is that from a policy perspective? You know, where are the settlers included, you know, and where is that included in terms of the construction of the state and the construction of the use of force, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, so the settlers are kind of understood to be sort of in an outpost where they're under threat from attacks by Palestinian insurgents. The mission of the IDF with regards to the West Bank is to protect the settlers, or at least in regards to the settlers. They have duties to Palestinians as well. But if you're placed in a settlement, your role is to protect the settlers, not necessarily to mediate between Palestinians and settlers. And so, yeah, I think you would probably find more settlers who are armed than the general population. There have been cases where settlers are shooting at Palestinians, even though the IDF is not. And so, you know, this is definitely a controversial issue. Now, the other component of this is that the more radical wing of the settler movement, and not all settlers are radical or sort right. of wide-eyed religious, you know, messy hair kind of, but that contingent is also engaged in acts of violence against the state specifically, in what's called the price tag attacks.
Right.
So when Israel evacuates an illegal outpost, an element of the settler movement will deface property. It's defaced mosques or something to that effect. And the idea is that there's a political price to be paid. And so that is a very serious issue for the state. And the state is very concerned about maintaining the rule of law. So to some extent, I think there's an understanding within the mainstream settler movement that they have to be very careful about the way that they play their political cards, because, you know, a violent response against the state, challenging the state's monopoly on the use of force, will have really serious implications for the political latitude that the state gives them as the issue of the West Bank becomes only increasingly more politically salient over time.
Well, that was a really good answer. Thank you. Do you have anything? I mean, we're hitting on probably one of the longer conversations I've had, so. No, it's really good.
Just wait until we do Lebanese politics. It'll be 3 hours.
God.
I would say Israel in a lot of ways is a state that's on its way towards becoming the next stage of whatever it's going to be. And so we always talk about the Middle East at a crossroads and Israel at a crossroads. But this particular crossroads is one where Israel has an opportunity to make a lot of progress. You have a prime minister who's being motivated by a centrist constituency. You have Yesh Atid that's being motivated by a centrist constituency. And there's a deep hunger within the Israeli population for reconciliation. There was a member of the Yesh Atid party named Ruth Calderon who gave a speech to the Knesset. And she started talking, this is a secular woman, talking about the Talmud, which is a set of books that's the first layer of interpretation of the Torah. And the secular woman talks about how the Talmud is so important to her and starts teaching a section of the Talmud in a Knesset speech. The MK who's presiding over the session is Yitzhak Vachnin, who's from the Shas party, which is this very religious party, and he comes in and starts participating with her in this conversation. And some members who are sitting in the Knesset are telling him to stop and let her speak, and she says, no, like, I am very happy to share in the learning of Talmud with this gentleman. And this speech gets put up on YouTube and goes viral. 220,000 people watch this video of a Knesset speech. 19,600 people watch the English version alone. So 240,000 people have seen this speech. And I think what that indicates is that there's a hunger for reconciliation and for moving past the status quo. And as I said before, you know, the importance of the J14 movement is not only the political concessions it was able to make, not only the ministers like Sav Shafir that it was able to push into the parliament to make a difference, but it demonstrates that the Israeli public will not be complacent when presented with a viable alternative to the status quo. So I think where that leaves governments and analysts is to continue to work to try and develop those alternatives and to try and establish a better condition on the ground, a more stable and more safe, a more prosperous and more democratic Israel for Israelis, for Palestinians, and for all of the constituencies in the greater Middle East as well.
Well, thank you so much. This has been really informative, and I hope, you know, people who listen to this will find it informative.
Great. Thank you so much for hosting these. They're really fun.